To some extent, it does. But the way in which this reflection process goes on, you know, may not be, as I said, a very simplistic thing like, you know, like light reflecting from a mirror. There may be some process. But what's definitely being said here is that there's some relationship between, like, the sun and all these other illuminating bodies in our universe. And that whatever power of illumination they have, somehow or other, they're getting it from the sun, which gets it from the Brahma Jyoti somehow. So there's some connections there. There's some connections there which, you know, these scientists wouldn't really recognize. You know, they would say there's nothing special about the sun, you know, that we see. They say there's nothing special about that particular body. It's just one out of trillions and trillions and trillions of other suns in the universe. But the Vedas don't say that. They say there is something special about the sun. You know, there is something special about it. All these other illuminating bodies, somehow or other, by some process, they're getting their power from, you know, the sun in one way or another. And of course, each one of them is presided over by some deity. There's some deity in charge of it. You know, just like there's a sun god who's in charge of the sun. So this is all very difficult for them because they want to see everything as simply material and impersonal. But it's not that they know that these things are like that, because after all, they haven't been out there, you know, to the stars to check them out, and been inside them to see if there's any deities there or not. You know, they don't know one way or the other. They can't really say. But what they have is they have this bias towards materialism and impersonalism and atheism that makes them think, you know, only in certain ways. But that's a big topic, and it's not exactly the topic of this class, so we'll continue with these verses. Of the Vedas, this is text 22, of the Vedas I am the Samaveda, and of the demigods I am Indra, the king of heavens, of the senses I am the mind, and in living beings I am the living force, consciousness. Text 23, of all the Rudras I am Lord Shiva, and of the Yakshas and Rakshasas I am the Lord of Wealth, Kuvera, of the Vasus I am Fire, Agni, and of the mountains I am Meru. Of priest, O Arjuna, know me to be the chief, Brihaspati. Of all generals, I am Kartikeya, and of bodies of water, I am the ocean. So this ocean, I mean, you get a lot, I mean, people really are fascinated by the ocean, and you really get a lot of people who see, you know, I mean, you really get a lot of this seeing God in nature kind of realization connected with the ocean. Of great sages, text 25, of the great sages I am Bhrigu, of vibrations I am the transcendental Om, of sacrifices I am the chanting of the holy names, Japa, and of immovable things I am the Himalayas. So in his purport about the Himalayas, which is one of these, I mean, people come from all over the world to see the Himalayas, right? I think there's something, many of them come with some spiritual idea. I don't think it's completely a material thing. So it says, Srila Prabhupada says, whatever is sublime in the world is a representation of Krishna. Therefore, the Himalayas, the greatest mountains in the world, also represent him. The mountain named Meru was mentioned in a previous verse, but Meru is sometimes movable, whereas the Himalayas are never movable. Thus, the Himalayas are greater than Meru. So you know, Krishna's all attractive, so I think these Himalayas are probably the most all attractive mountains in the world, right? People just come from all over. You see all kinds of tourists, you know, they want to come, go to the Himalayas. Of course, they leave all this trash up there. You know, it's sometimes they even get killed climbing those mountains. So anyway, so that's their penance, austerity. Of all trees, Krishna says, I am the banyan tree and of sages among the demigods. I am Narada of the Gandharvas. I am Chitrarata among the perfected beings. I am the sage Kapila. Of horses, know me to be Uchai Shrava, produced during the churning of the ocean of nectar. Of lordly elephants, I am Airavata, and among men, I am the monarch. Of weapons, I am the thunderbolt. Among cows, I am the Sarabi. Of causes for procreation, I am Kandarpa, the god of love. And of serpents, I am Vasuki. Of the many-hooded Nagas, I am Ananta. And among aquatics, I am the demigod Varuna. Of departed ancestors, I am Aryama. And among the dispensers of law, I am Yama, the lord of death. So some of these things aren't things that, you know, your average Western person will be knowledgeable about. But you know, there are people who accept Vedic culture who will understand these things. Among the Daitya demons, I am the devoted Prahlad. Among subduers, I am Time. Among beasts, I am the lion. And among birds, I am Garuda. So this lion thing is something people are very fascinated about. Of purifiers, I am the wind, and of wielders of weapons, I am Rama. Of fishes, I am the shark, and of flowing rivers, I am the Ganges. So, said here, of all the aquatics, the shark is one of the biggest and is certainly the most dangerous to man. Thus, the shark represents Krishna. Actually, Krishna has shark-shaped earrings, too. He sometimes wears those. And they really are kind of ferocious. You ever see these films about the great white sharks and things like that? Jaws. Yeah. So that's the reason it's like that. It's because that's a representation of Krishna. That's, you know, it's the people are. I mean, I lived in San Diego Temple for a while, which is right on the beach. But every few years, you know, there's something that would happen down there. You know, like, yeah, you know, they'd find, you know, somebody's surfboard, you know, like bitten in half and couldn't find, you know, the. So I wouldn't go in the ocean. Because I figured it'd be just the way that, you know, just my luck. So the shark thing, it really gets people. And so that's a manifestation of Krishna because it's so dangerous. Most dangerous, vicious kind of creature. Of all creations, I am the beginning and the end and also the middle. O Arjuna, of all sciences, I am the spiritual science of the self. And among logicians, I am the conclusive truth. Of letters, I am the letter A. And among compound words, I am the dual compound. I am also inexhaustible time. And of creators, I am Brahma. I am all-devouring death. Yeah, sometimes you get people expressing that sort of vision, you know, the kind of these battlefield poets who just, in the midst of, sometimes you hear that from Vietnam veterans, people like that, that they're, you know, just kind of in the middle of a big battle when they just see people getting killed all around them. That's when they understand God, you know. You know, when they see death happening all around them. And I am the generating principle of all that is yet to be. Among women, I am fame, fortune, fine speech, memory, intelligence, steadfastness, and patience. Of the hymns in the Samaveda, I am the Brihat Sama, and of poetry, I am Gayatri. Of months, I am Marga Shirsha, November, December, and of seasons, I am the flower-bearing spring. And so we just had, you know, the celebration of this Vasant Panchami, the flower-bearing spring season. So that's a manifestation of Krishna. In the final paragraph of the purport, Srila Prabhupada explains a little bit. He says, the month of November, December is considered the best of all months because in India, grains are collected from the fields at this time and people become very happy. Of course, spring is a season universally liked because it is neither too hot nor too cold. And the flowers and trees blossom and flourish. In spring, there are also many ceremonies commemorating Krishna's pastime. pastimes. Therefore, this is considered to be the most joyful of all seasons, and it is the representative of the Supreme Lord Krishna. You know, so we're now in that season. Then, Krishna says, I am also the gambling of cheats. And that's also something very wonderful to see. And the splendid, I am splendor. I am victory, I am adventure, and I am the strength of the strong. So this is very, and these are very wonderful things for people. The sense of adventure, people like that, that's a manifestation of Krishna. Of the descendants of Rishni, I am Vasudeva. Of the Pandavas, I am Arjuna. Of the sages, I am Vyas. Among great thinkers, I am Ushana. Among all means of suppressing lawlessness, I am punishment. And of those who seek victory, I am morality. Of secret things, I am silence. And of the wise, I am the wisdom. So, in his purport, Srila Prabhupada says, there are many suppressing agents, of which the most important are those that cut down miscreants. When miscreants are punished, the agency of chastisement represents Krishna. So people like movies like that. They like these movies where you have these big, powerful people that cut down the miscreants. You know, Arnold Schwarzenegger and people like that. They just love to see the miscreants blown away. But that's the reason for that is, there's a deeper reason for that. That's the agent of chastisement is Krishna, ultimately. Furthermore, O Arjuna, I am the generating seed of all existences. There is no being moving or non-moving that can exist without me. O mighty conqueror of enemies, there is no end to my divine manifestations. What I have spoken to you is but a mere indication of my infinite opulences. And then finally, this is the limitation of this vision, of this level of God realization. Krishna explains it himself. He says, know that all opulent, beautiful, and glorious creations spring from but a spark of my splendor. His purport, Srila Prabhupada says, any glorious or beautiful existence should be understood to be but a fragmental manifestation of Krishna's opulence, whether it be in the spiritual or material world. Anything extraordinarily opulent should be considered to represent Krishna's opulence. And so that's the defect, is there are people who these kinds of visions, more or less to this standard, whatever level of consciousness they happen to be at. The problem is they accept that that is the supreme vision of God. And it's not. And Krishna is explaining that here. He says all this is just a spark of his splendor. And then Krishna just kind of cuts off this particular line of conversation with Arjuna. He says, but what need is there, Arjuna, for all this detailed knowledge with a single fragment of myself, I pervade and support this entire universe. There's one more section, chapter 15, 12. Text 12 to 14. So you go to chapter 15. Krishna present in nature. So in text 12, Krishna says, the splendor of the sun, which dissipates the darkness of this whole world, comes from me, and the splendor of the moon and the splendor of fire are also from me. And then I enter into each planet, and by my energy they stay in orbit. I become the moon, and thereby supply the juice of life to all vegetables. And in text 14, I am the fire of digestion in the bodies of all living entities, and I join with the air of life, ongoing, outgoing and incoming, to digest the four kinds of food stuff. So then, in the purport to text 12, kind of close with that, Srila Prabhupada says, the unintelligent cannot understand how things are taking place, but one can begin to be established in knowledge by understanding what the Lord explains here. So this is kind of like a beginning step in attaining the ultimate levels of God realization. That's what this kind of vision can help one do. Everyone sees the sun, moon, fire, and electricity. One should simply try to understand that the splendor of the sun, the splendor of the moon, and the splendor of electricity, or fire, are coming from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In such a conception of life, the beginning of Krishna consciousness, lies a great deal of advancement for the conditioned soul in this world. So Srila Prabhupada is saying that this kind of vision, if we can communicate it to people, can be the beginning of their spiritual life, and they can actually make a great deal of advancement, you know, from learning to see these different, how Krishna is present in these different manifestations, like the electricity, like lightning, do you live in countries where you have a great deal of lightning and electricity in the sky, northern lights, things like that.
Yeah, what are the northern lights?
It's electricity. It's Krishna. It's very beautiful sometimes. When I was in the Navy, I was stationed in Iceland and I saw them for the first time, because that's up by the Arctic Circle. And just go out and see these huge patterns. It's like a big transcendental light show. But, that's Krishna saying, electricity. That's lightning, the northern lights, things like that. This is all part of Krishna's opulence. And as Srila Prabhupada said here, if people could be taught to see these things, in such a conception of life, the beginning of Krishna consciousness lies a great deal of advancement for the conditioned soul in this material world. But it's not the ultimate thing. So this is, how do you get this kind of vision? You can see it with your, you don't have to have divine eyes. You can see it with your regular vision, but you have to be guided by scripture, ultimately. That's the best thing. People speculate and concoct, their different visions, but if you're actually guided by, the Bhagavad Gita, then it becomes very helpful, very progressive, whereas the other kinds of things may not be so progressive, at least not to such a great degree. And what it gives you is it gives you a kind of sense of wonder from which you can actually build on to come to higher levels of God realization. But the disadvantage of it, or the drawback, is this: it's only a spark of Krishna's splendor. But if people just think, well, if God's reflection in nature is so wonderful, then how much more wonderful must God be, Himself in His own right? So we'll stop there. Any final comments, questions? We got through everything. Okay, then. Tomorrow and the next day we'll be talking about the super soul level of God realization. Jai, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. So today we're going to start our examination of super soul as a level of God realization in Bhagavad Gita, but you were saying you had some points you want to make, Vedavyas, about... God and nature, did that dissipate? Did that desire dissipate overnight? Okay. You wanted to do it right then and there. Okay. All right, so well, we'll have 2 days, today and tomorrow, for the Super Soul, so there should be plenty of chance for everyone to express their realizations. I want to start out with something from Srimad Bhagavatam. Of course, the Super Soul is Krishna's localized expansion. We know from the statements of Shastra, you know, Vadanti tat tatva vidhas tatvam yaj jnanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavaniti shadyate. You know, those who are learned see that the absolute truth has three principal features: Brahman, his impersonal effulgence, and then Paramatma, his localized expansion, and then Bhagavan, his full personality, you know, the full personality of Godhead, full of all opulences. So, in Srimad Bhagavatam, in the second canto, second chapter, text 35, there's the following text, which is spoken by Shukadeva Goswami, and he says, "The personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, is in every living being along with the individual soul. And this fact is perceived and hypothesized in our acts of seeing and taking help from the intelligence." So in his purport, Srila Prabhupada gives a very elaborate set of meditations by which even an average person can understand the existence of Super Soul. There are different ways to realize the Super Soul. One is by, you know, the yoga process, but just to get an idea of it, as Sukadeva Goswami says, just by examining our acts of seeing and how we take help from our intelligence, we can gain some understanding of the Super Soul, you know, even without going through all of the Ashtanga yoga processes. So it's a very interesting purport. If you have time, you know, you should. How many of you recall reading that? It's in the second canto. It's where Prabhupada calls the Super Soul the form direction of, intelligence is the form direction of Super Soul. So you've read that. And it's a very nice, actually somebody could probably do a course, you know, like do a workshop on this for people. You know, like take them through these different meditations, you know, so that they can appreciate the existence of the Super Soul. And that's how I want to start out today, to go through the different steps of this, you know, meditation that Srila Prabhupada proposes that can help us understand the existence of the Super Soul. So the first thing that Srila Prabhupada says in this step-by-step process says, one can perceive one's self-identification and feel positively that he exists. So this is the first step, is just to, I mean, we can all sort of appreciate that we exist, right? I mean, everybody can kind of just meditate on it. You know, you can think, well, hey, I exist. Yeah, you can feel pretty positively that you exist, right? That's what he says. He says, yeah, one can perceive one's self-identification, yeah, me, I, yeah, and feel positively that he exists. And so it's a positive feeling, yes, I exist. And then he says, and then the second step is, Srila Prabhupada says, slowly, gradually, you know, by, you know, applying one's intelligence, he can feel that he is not the body. In other words, we can go down the different, the list of the different parts of the body, the hands, the arms, the legs, the feet, and we can appreciate. We say, well, my head, my arms, my legs, my this, my that. So gradually, you can understand anyone can come to understand that we're actually not this body. We can come to understand that. And then, so then what you do then is you can distinguish and separate yourself from other things that you see besides your body, too. We can understand, well, just like I'm not my hands, my legs, I'm also not the table or the chair or the sky or the sun. In other words, Srila Prabhupada says we start to make a distinction between the seer and the seen. And so the first thing is we just establish that we exist. And then we can kind of perceive, anyone can, by applying their intelligence a little bit, they can understand that they're different than their body and different than other things that they can see. Of course, this is what Shukadeva Goswami is saying. He says, the fact of the Supersoul is perceived and hypothesized in our acts of seeing and taking help from the intelligence. So what Srila Prabhupada's doing in the first part of this purport, he's dealing with the seeing aspect, that we can see. Oh, yeah, we can feel that we exist. We can see, oh, I'm not this body. I'm not everything that I see around me. So then you make this basic distinction between the seer and the seen. Then, we also learn, we can also see that as seers, we're not really so independent. We're not independent in what we can see. He sees that beyond himself, all of these. Actually, what Srila Prabhupada does is he breaks it down. We can see that we have our different senses, our five knowledge-acquiring senses. The power to see, the power to hear, the power to taste, the power to touch, the power to smell. And then we have our five working senses, the arms, the legs, the organs of evacuation and reproduction, and the speech, the power of speech. And then we have our mind, our intelligence, our ego. So we can see that these things are not things that we've created ourselves. Somehow or other, we've been given all of these things. So we're not really independent, say, in our power to act and do things and to see. And the same thing with the objects of perception. We're not really creating everything that we see. We don't create our power of vision, nor do we create the things that we see around us. All of those things are there. They're combinations of the material energy which is out there in nature. And so then we have this a basic distinction between the seer and the seen, but then we understand that there's a further distinction. It's like the distinction between spirit and matter, or consciousness and matter. That the seer is conscious, and what is seen is material. It's like, and he says psychologically we can appreciate this because we feel like limited and conditioned by our material surroundings. We're kind of there's always some kind of frustration or dissatisfaction, with our material senses and the material sense objects. So we have this distinction between the seer and the seen. We begin to understand it's a distinction between spirit and matter. As Srila Prabhupada says, the spiritual quality of the seer is manifest in our dissatisfaction with the limited state of materially conditioned existence. So So anyway, so we can see how this has gradually developed, this meditation. First, you just start with saying, well, I exist. And then you go further to understanding you're not the body, you're not the things that you can see with your senses. And then we understand there's a difference between a seer and the seen. And that difference of the seer and the seen is the difference between consciousness and matter. Now, then Srila Prabhupada points out, and at this point, he says somebody might say, well, this distinction between matter and the consciousness is a false one, because what really happens is simply that matter, at a certain stage of combining itself, develops the ability to see and hear and smell and be aware of things, so on and so forth. He says that's a very bad argument, because there's no evidence that matter, at any point anybody's ever put together matter and gotten a living entity that is conscious out of it. So he said that's a bad argument. So you have this distinction between the seer and the seen, between consciousness and matter, or spirit and matter. Now we move from there to intelligence. Because, alright, so now we've got this conscious being, it's involved with matter, it's seeing matter, matter's moving around it, and it's also interacting, you know, with the matter. But we see that this conscious self, it can't really do anything independently without taking help of intelligence. So, just like, if we don't properly take help of intelligence, then it's like we become crazy, we become insane. You know, like, just like, you know, if you're decide you're going to leave this room, like if you're intelligent, you'll go out the door and use the stairs, and if you're not so intelligent, you'll open that door and jump out. So that's intelligence. Like, we don't have intelligence. We don't, because your intelligence will tell you, like, no, don't do that. That's not good. And the intelligence will say, yeah, go out the door, you know, go down the stairs. In the same way, we're always taking help from our intelligence at every moment. You know, you can just see, you know, like we're always, do we cross the street or not? You know, our intelligence says, well, look and see if there's a big bus or a truck or something coming. But if we're not intelligent, then we just cross the street. That's crazy. Yeah, so if we don't take help from our intelligence, then we're insane. So this intelligence is like some higher power, you know, that's guiding us. Like Srila Prabhupada says, a living being cannot see or move or eat or do anything without the aid of intelligence. So then we notice, for we see this in ourselves, and then we see it in others. So this is like a kind of realization of the super soul, when we understand that we're always dependent upon this, you know, we're different from matter, you know, we're the seer, not the seen, but in our power of seeing and discriminating and acting, we're dependent upon intelligence, which must be coming from somewhere. So that somewhere is the super soul. And then we can conclude that also that, well, not only am I getting intelligence, but it appears that other people are also getting intelligence. You know, so that we can see that this, whatever it is that's giving intelligence, is not just situated in me, it's distributed. It's in everyone. And that there must be similarly some kind of intelligence behind this whole display of nature. So this is a way which anybody can come to see, you know, the existence of the super soul. And then And then Srila Prabhupada then also gives a point. He says that, well, so he says, so now we've understood three things, that there's the seer, the seen, and the superseer, or the intelligence, or you could say the living entity, matter, and this super soul. But then he says, like, if you have this superior intelligence, there must be more to it than that. You know, like, how could it just be that it would just be there to help me, you know, learn whether to eat chapatis or dirt? You know, it's like, so he said, God must be something more than that, just logically. So then we can appreciate that the Supersoul is just a partial representation of God, that God himself must have more to do than just supervise the activities of all kinds of insignificant living beings in this universe. So it's actually quite a nice purport. I think it's a very useful kind of meditation, both for ourselves and then, and I think somebody could actually develop that and even hold little workshops on it, give people this meditation where they can learn about the super soul and appreciate that there must be even more than the super soul. So, does anybody have any questions or observations up to this point? Yeah, you can make a note of that. It's Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 2, Text 35. You know, it's really a really amazing, you know, purport. You know, how Srila Prabhupada goes to this whole meditation. You know, how by, you know, explaining what Sukadeva Goswami says, that we can, you know, the personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, is in every living being along with the individual soul, and this fact is perceived and hypothesized in our acts of seeing and taking help from the intelligence. Yeah.
The problem we find in this process is that most of the conditioned soul, most of us, we think that we are intelligent. We have become intelligent when we do something great. We think this is me. Like,
right.
I've done this.
Right.
And therefore, this is when the intelligence is identified as the person we're seeing, so identify himself with we can identify ourselves with the intelligence, and therefore we deem ourselves in the intelligence. And that, I guess, some type of illusion.
Yeah, but I think just this is where you have to be very observant, you know, about your inner workings. Because you'll see that what you'll observe is that you, whoever it is, you know, the conscious self, is actually taking help, you know, from the intelligence. It's not like, you know, if you really observe what's going on, you know, like when you're trying to decide whether to do something or not, you know, like, you know, it's almost you're like listening, you know, for something, you know, well, should I or shouldn't I, you know, and then finally it comes to you, well, don't do it. It's not like, it's like you're actually listening to something. You know, if you can actually see that you're actually, you know, it's not coming directly, you know, from you, if you're very observant about it. And many, even scientists and philosophers and things like that, they'll be saying, well, like, you know, I was trying to solve some problems, a very complicated, you know, mathematical problem. I was thinking about it, and I couldn't get it, and then just out of the blue it came to me once, you know, like one famous mathematician said, just, you know, like as I was putting my foot up to get on a bus, you know, it came to me, you know, like, So artists and people like this, you know, they are like composers like Mozart, people like that. They would say, like, I was just riding out in a park or walking through a park, and the whole symphony just kind of came, write to me. And then I just went back home and I wrote it all out. You know, but it's like these, and whether we're talking about these very great artistic insights or mathematical insights, or even just, you know, should I cross the street or not? You know, we can see that if we really analyze what's going on, we can see that it's like we're a conscious entity and we're taking help from some other source. Now, of course, this is a common mistake. Like it's said, even the yogis, when they finally realize the super soul, they think it's themselves. So in this other kind of meditation that we're doing, that can happen. You know, people may think, well, I am the source of that intelligence. And some we may be able to convince that they're not, and some we may not be able to convince. that's just the nature of things.
You mean that the person takes help from the intelligence which comes from the secret soul.
Yeah.
So actually, if a person is fully realized, he cannot have any kind of pride, false pride.
No, he'll realize, it's all coming from Krishna. Yeah. Just like Srila Prabhupada says, like Krishna was dictating these books to me, or Krishna Das Kaviraj, would say, like when he was writing the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's like Krishna was making the words dance, and I, was just putting them down. And then when Krishna stops, then, nothing more. So you're right, those who are on these higher platforms of realization, they do become, very humble, because they realize that ultimately, they're just the instruments. Like, just like Krishna is saying to Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, you just become the instrument. Actually, I've killed everyone, but you can just become the instrument. And then Krishna wants his devotees to take the credit for different activities. So, Krishna likes to arrange things like that. But the real credit will be, the devotee gives credit to Krishna or to a spiritual master, like that. Yeah.
You said, like Krishna said about that for one whose mind is controlled, then it's supposed to be already weak.
Right. So we're going to go through those verses. Yeah. Yeah. The mind is the business of the mind is to accept or reject. To do something or not do something, to like it or not like it. I like this, I don't like it. I want to do it, I don't want to do it. It's good, it's bad. The mind is into this accepting and rejecting mode. So what the intelligence does is it helps the mind, so should I go or not go? And the intelligence will say, go. So if we have proper intelligence, then in all these decisions, if you look, every single day, at every moment, we have to decide to do something or not do something. Do I like it or don't like it? Like starting right from the morning, should I get up or not get up? Right? Should I get up or not get up? And the intelligence says, you're supposed to get up, for Mangal Arti, to go see the deities. I mean, at every moment we have a choice to do something or not do something. So if we're being properly guided by Super Soul, ultimately, because Super Soul will give us the intelligence. Krishna says, if we're favorably inclined to him, then he gives the intelligence how to approach him. So then we'll always get the proper intelligence. But then if something, the real freedom of Krishna consciousness, it actually occurs at some very, very deep level, that we simply have the ability to desire to surrender to Krishna or not. And then according to that, then Krishna gives us all kinds of intelligence. And we may think, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, but really Krishna is giving the intelligence. It's like, an example that I like to use is, I don't know if they still do this, but when I was a little kid, two years old or 1 year old or something, they used to have in the cars these baby seats, and it would have a little steering wheel on it. So the little baby would be in the car, the father or mother would be driving the car, little kids in his little seat in the car. I'm going here, I'm going there. Actually, he's not, but he thinks he is, and he's enjoying it immensely. Really, who's driving is the father, who's making the car go this way and that way. And even the kid might say, like, oh, let's go here or go there. And the father might say, okay, we'll go there. But the kid will think like he's doing it. So we're kind of like that. Super soul's actually doing everything, giving us the intelligence, but we think we're the doers. So we can get into that. Oh, somebody had some other comments? Well, the mind is necessary. It's part of the connection between like the soul and the body. We can't get rid of it. But we can spiritualize it, so it's always just like in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, if you're in Krishna consciousness, your mind can be your best friend, and if you're not, it can be your worst enemy. So we don't get rid of the mind really, but we can spiritualize it, so that it's always taking proper help from Krishna conscious intelligence. So in any case, there's quite a bit of information in the Bhagavad Gita about the super soul. There's some additional text other than the ones that I put here that we can consider. Like 6, 7, 6:13 to 14. We can note these down. 6:29. 6:31, 13, 14 through 18, chapter 17, text 5 through 6, and 18:14. So those are all texts that we can consider. In addition to the ones that are already listed there. So we can start with chapter 6. This is where Krishna explains the yoga system. And the purpose of that yoga system was to realize the super soul. So starting with text 7 in that chapter. This is the verse that Sri Vrindavan was talking about, I think. Text 7. For one who has conquered the mind, the supersoul is already reached, for he has attained tranquility. To such a man, happiness and distress, heat and cold, honor and dishonor are all the same. And in his purport, Srila Prabhupada says, actually, every living entity is intended to abide by the dictation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is seated in everyone's heart as Paramatma. And then later on in the purport, he says, one has to abide by superior dictation. When one's mind is fixed on the superior nature, he has no alternative but to follow the dictation of the Supreme. The mind must admit some superior dictation and follow it. The effect of controlling the mind is that one automatically follows the dictation of the Paramatma or Supersoul. Of course, controlling the mind means man mana bhava man bhakto, focusing the mind on Krishna. Savai mana Krishna padara vindayo. If one can focus the mind on Krishna, then one will get the proper intelligence, so that the mind always knows, is always making the right decisions. So this, Sri Prabhupada says in the end, this state is practical samadhi, or absorption in the Supreme. Then, in text 13 and 14 in this chapter, One should hold one's body, neck, and head erect in a straight line and stare steadily at the tip of the nose. Thus, with an unagitated, subdued mind, devoid of fear, completely free from sex life, one should meditate upon me within the heart and make me the ultimate goal of life. In the purport, the goal of life is to know Krishna, who is situated within the heart of every living being as Paramatma, the four-handed Vishnu form. The yoga process is practiced in order to discover and see this localized form of Vishnu and not for any other purpose. The localized Vishnumurti is the plenary representation of Krishna dwelling within one's heart. One who has no program to realize this Vishnumurti is uselessly engaged in mock yoga practice and is certainly wasting his time. Krishna is the ultimate goal of life, and the Vishnumurti situated in one's heart is the object of yoga practice. To realize this Vishnumurti within the heart, one has to observe complete abstinence from sex life. Therefore, one has to leave home and live alone in a secluded place, remaining seated as mentioned above. One cannot enjoy sex life daily at home or elsewhere and attend a so-called yoga class and thus become a yogi. One has to practice controlling the mind and avoiding all kinds of sense gratification, of which sex life is the chief. So it goes on and on about that, and just making the point, you know, absolutely clear about this, how important this practice of brahmacharya really is. Of course, I was reflecting again, you know, from my personal experience. I think it. One time I became interested in this yoga business. And I actually decided to follow this advice. It wasn't from Bhagavad Gita, but again, just to leave home, go to the forest, and sit down and meditate until I realized the super soul and left my body or something. So I actually tried to do that. I was living in Florida, and I decided, well, where should I go? So I heard about Boulder, Colorado and the Rocky Mountains and how people go up there to meditate. So I got on an airplane and I flew to Boulder, to Denver, and, you know, went to Boulder, Colorado. And, you know, it's a university town. Then I walked out of the university town and I saw the mountains and I walked straight up the mountains. And I said, I'm just going to sit here and I'm going to practice yoga and I'm never going to come down again. I'm just going to stay. I'm going to fast. I'm not going to take any water, any food. I'm just going to fast and meditate until, you know, I realize it, whatever it is. So that lasted about 36 hours, I think, you know, like a day and a night. Then kind of the mind, you know, just dragged me back down the mountain, back to Denver, back on the airplane, you know, back to Florida. So, No, this is before. As I said, before I became a devotee, I tried many, many things. This is before I became a devotee. A fully surrendered devotee. Yeah. So, going on. So also in this chapter, text 29. And here Krishna says, a true yogi observes me in all beings and also sees every being in me. Also in this chapter, text 29. And here Krishna says, a true yogi observes me in all beings and also sees every being in me. Indeed, the self-realized person sees me the same Supreme Lord everywhere. In his purport, Sri Prabhupada explains, a Krishna conscious yogi is the perfect seer because he sees Krishna, the Supreme, situated in everyone's heart as Super Soul, Paramatma. The Lord in his Paramatma feature is situated within both the heart of a dog and that of a Brahmana. So, I guess a lot of times book distributors say they get this realization, you know, that, you know, when they're out there and they understand finally that they're not the doers, and, you know, people are taking books and things, they realize it's the super soul in a person's heart giving them direction to take the book and give a contribution. So then in text 31, Krishna says, such a yogi who engages in the worshipful service of the super soul, knowing that I and the super soul are one, remains always in me in all circumstances. So in the purport, Srila Prabhupada explains, says, a yogi who is practicing meditation on the super soul sees within himself the plenary portion of Krishna as Vishnu, with four hands holding a conch shell, wheel, club, and lotus flower. The yogi should know that Vishnu is not different from Krishna. Krishna in this form of super soul is situated in everyone's heart. Furthermore, there is no difference between the innumerable super souls present in the innumerable hearts of living entities, nor is there a difference between a Krishna conscious person always engaged in the transcendental loving service of Krishna and a perfect yogi engaged in meditation on the super soul. A little bit later on in the purport, the last paragraph, Srila Prabhupada says, Krishna consciousness is the highest stage of trance in yoga practice. This very understanding that Krishna is present as Paramatma in everyone's heart makes the yogi faultless. It's like when we're paying obeisances to devotees. Srila Prabhupada says, actually we're paying obeisances to the Supreme Lord within the hearts of the devotees as well. So the idea here is that the real object of this yoga practice is to realize the super soul, but the method that's prescribed here is not really possible for the conditioned souls of this age. So therefore, at the very end of this chapter 6, there's the famous verse, Yoginam Abhisarvesham Madgatena Dharamana Shradavam Bhajateyo Vam Same Yukdatavo Mataha, where Krishna says that the real yogi is, the highest one, is the one who is just constantly worshipping him with love and devotion. In other words, the bhakti yogi. Then, the next text that we have to consider is chapter 7, text 21. And this is one that we went over already when we were talking about the demigods. And in this verse, Krishna says, I am in everyone's heart as the super soul. As soon as one desires to worship some demigod, I make his faith steady so that he can devote himself to that particular deity. So Krishna is there in the heart, and he's observing the desires of the particular living entities, and he gives them the particular desire to worship a particular demigod. He can also give them, of course, reveal himself, if that's the desire of the living entity. To understand the super soul, for example, then Krishna can give them the faith to do that as well. Then the next text we want to go to is in chapter 8. Oh, you stretching or raising your hand? Okay. 8:4. So this one, Krishna says, the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, see, the indestructible transcendental living entity is called Brahma, and his eternal nature is called Adhyatma, the self. Oh, let's see. No, okay, I had the wrong verse there. I was reading 3, I wanted 4. So text 4, chapter 8. O best of the embodied beings, the physical nature, which is constantly changing, is called Adibhuta, the material manifestation. The universal form of the Lord, which includes all the demigods, like those of the sun and the moon, is called Adidaiva. And I, the Supreme Lord, represented as the super soul in the heart of every embodied being, am called Adiyajna, the Lord of sacrifice. Then in his purport, Srila Prabhupada says, he makes a nice point here. He says, present in the body along with the individual soul is the super soul, a plenary representation of Lord Krishna. The super soul is called the Paramatma or the Adi Yajna and is situated in the heart. The word Eva is particularly important in the context of this verse because by this word the Lord stresses that the Paramatma is not different from him. The super soul, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, seated beside the individual soul, is the witness of the individual soul's activities and is the source of the soul's various types of consciousness. The super soul gives the individual soul an opportunity to act freely and witnesses his activities. So that's another function of the super soul, is to witness the activities of the living entity and give the living entity its karma. So does anybody have any questions or comments about any of these texts that we're going over? Okay. So then, there's chapter 13, which is a whole chapter about the super soul, which we'll go over tomorrow. And so now we'll just go over some of the other verses that are there besides the ones in chapter 13, which is a whole chapter about the super soul. In chapter 15, text 15, Krishna talks about the super soul. It's a very famous verse. Sarvasya chaham, priti sanavishto, matasmritir gyanam apohanam cha, vedaischa sarvaraham eva vedyo, vedanta krit vedavit eva chaham. Translation, I am seated in everyone's heart, and from me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. And that's the part about the super soul. And in his purport, Srila Prabhupada explains, the Supreme Lord is situated as Paramatma in everyone's heart, and it is from him that all activities are initiated. The living entity forgets everything of his past life, but he has to act according to the direction of the Supreme Lord, who is the witness to all his work. Therefore, he begins his work according to his past deeds. Required knowledge is supplied to him, and remembrance is given to him, and he forgets also about his past life. Thus, the Lord is not only all-pervading, he is localized in every individual heart. So this super soul is giving memory, knowledge, and forgetfulness. And ultimately, he's giving memory, knowledge, and forgetfulness of himself. Because originally, we're all Krishna-conscious living beings. That's our original condition, to be, Krishna-conscious. And then, as it's described in the Prema Vivarta, it said, Krishna bahir mukahana bhogavanchakare nikatashta mayatare japati adare. Krishna bahir mukha means, bahir mukha means to turn the face away, to face away from something. So Krishna bahir mukha, when we want to turn away from Krishna, Krishna bahir mukahana. Why? Bhogavanchakare. Bhoga means desire for sense enjoyment. So when we desire sense enjoyment, desire to turn away from Krishna, then nikatashta mayatari, then maya is right there, right beside Krishna, and she takes over then. And then, of course, she's acting under Krishna's control. So what happens is then we forget our original spiritual identity, because we all have a swarupa. Swarupa is our original spiritual form. Muktir hitvanyata rupam swarupena vivasati. Liberation simply means coming and getting the original spiritual form. And in the Vedanta Sutra commentaries of the great Vaishnava Acharyas, it said that this form, they discuss this, they say, is the form that you get at liberation, is that new, is that something new, or is it something old? And in the commentaries on the Vedanta Sutra, the Acharyas say, oh, it's not something new, it's old. They actually say that it's in the Vedanta Sutra that that form in the liberated state, it's expanded, and then when the soul becomes conditioned, the form becomes like contracted, and then when you're go back to Godhead, then it again expands. So super soul is the one who's causing us to forget our original spiritual form, to forget our original spiritual home, to forget our original object of love and affection, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And so then he gives us the kind of, since we want to enjoy ourselves in the material world, he gives us the knowledge how to do that. And we see people have so much knowledge how to do so many things in this material world. So it's the super soul that's giving them that knowledge. To build all these trucks and factories and airplanes and computers and engage in all these activities of sense gratification very expertly. Building these huge cities and making these movies and television shows and doing so many things very expertly. That's all coming from Krishna, ultimately. Giving them that knowledge. But if we desire within our heart, or by some fortunate circumstance we come in contact with a pure devotee of the Lord who helps us awaken this desire deep within the heart, then Krishna will give us the facility to remember him, to remember our original spiritual home, to remember our original spiritual identity. He'll give us the knowledge to attain these things. It's like Krishna says, Vedaischa savarahame vivedyo. Veda means knowledge. So Krishna gives the Vedic knowledge. It's there. And we can take advantage of it. That's Krishna giving knowledge externally. And he can also give it internally as well. He can give us the knowledge internally to do these things. And just like Krishna has caused us, the conditioned souls, to forget their original spiritual nature, their original spiritual home, their original spiritual activities, the original personality of Godhead, he can ultimately cause us to forget this material existence. So this is up to the super soul. So looks like we're at the end of our allotted time. Maybe I'll explain tomorrow. There's a very nice analogy in the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam about the super soul. It's the story of King Puranjana. Which is, maybe we can talk about that tomorrow. It's a very excellent kind of story to help us understand our position, the position of the super soul, like that. So, any final observations, Veda Vyas? Today we'll continue our discussion of super soul. Even though the soul may leave Krishna, Krishna never leaves any of his parts and parcels. Because even if they're not with him in the spiritual world, he accompanies them on their journey through the material world, and he's just waiting for them to turn their face back to him so he can give them guidance about how to return to their real spiritual home, and he can reveal himself again in his full form. Srila Prabhupada says that this super soul form, it's not the complete form of Krishna or God. It's he says it's sort of like when if there's a fair being held in a certain place, then the government will appoint, you know, some special police officer to look over, you know, the safety of the citizens as long as the fair is going on. And then as soon as the fair is over, then there's no more need for that particular official. So in the same way, it's sort of like we've gathered for this little fair of material existence. And as long as that's going on, then Krishna, you know, he'll be present here as a super soul. And there's a nice, as I was mentioning yesterday, there's a very nice explanation of this whole process in the fourth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's a nice, a whole series of chapters there, the story of King Paranjana, which is an allegory that Narada Muni relates to King Prachinabarhishat. You know, if you haven't read it yet, I mean, it's very interesting. You know, it's just like a very exciting and very colorful story that has so many levels of meaning to it, you know, that can help us understand the position of the soul in the material world and its relationship to the mind and the body and intelligence and so on and so forth. But just briefly, like the story of this king, Paranjana, is that he left his home and he was searching for a new residence. And as he was searching for this new residence, he was accompanied by someone who was known as his Avigyata Saka. So Avigyata means unknown and Saka means friend. So he had this unknown friend who was always kind of watching over him, following him. And so he came to a particular place. It's called the City of Nine Gates. And he went inside this city and he saw there were some beautiful gardens there. So he was kind of wandering around the garden and he saw this extremely attractive lady. And she appeared to be attracted to him too. So they began a conversation and she invited him, said, "Well, why don't you live with me in this beautiful city here?" And he said, "All right," but then he was kind of a little concerned because he saw she wasn't alone. She had some friends with her. There was this big, hulking bodyguard who had 10 other bodyguards with him. And then there was this big snake with 5 heads. And actually, each of the bodyguards had many servants and wives. You know, so it was a whole entourage there. So he said, "Well, yeah, kind of like you, but who are all these other?" You know, do they kind of come along with the package? And she said, "Don't worry about them. Don't worry about them. I don't even really know who they are. They've always been here. You know, they've just always been here. I don't know about them. I don't know where they came from or, you know, how I came to be here. Let's just," essentially what she says, "let's just be here now and enjoy life in this city." So he agreed to that proposal. And life went on for some time in the City of Nine Gates like that until finally there is this other king named Kaliyavana came, and he had these soldiers, 360 white ones and 360 black ones, and they kind of ripped down the walls of the city and they burned it down, and they, Kaliyavana, and, you know, they took, you know, the king was taken, you know, captured and taken out of the city, you know, as it was burning. And then, but in any case, like, of course, the allegory is that the City of Nine Gates is the material body, you know, which has its 9 openings, the male body anyways, if you count them. You know, the 2 eyes, the 2 ears, the 2 nostrils, the mouth, you know, the organs for evacuation and reproduction, you know, the 9 gates. So, and the queen is like intelligence, material intelligence, you know, not the spiritual intelligence of the soul, but material intelligence, which is sort of beckoning, yes, just come, enjoy, you know, enjoy life in the material world and the material body. And the big bodyguard, the chief bodyguard, is the mind, and then the 10 other ones were the 10 senses, the 5 knowledge acquiring senses, and then the 5 working senses. And then the serpent with 5 heads was the prana, you know, the airs. You know, there's 5 principal airs, you know, that circulate through the body and sort of keep the whole machinery of it going. And so he would, so in company, and then the wives and all that, they represented all the various material desires, you know, the wives of these different senses. You know, servants, you know, represented the millions and millions of desires that there are. So he just became entangled in this whole situation. And then Kalyavana, of course, represents, you know, the force of time and death and all that. And because at a certain point, what happens is that the city of 9 gates is destroyed, and then the king and all his entourage are taken out. And then what happened is, because he was so attached to this queen, he took on the body of woman in the next life, because that's what happened. He was taken out, and then that's what happens at the time of death. You're taken out of this body, and then according to your mental state, then you go into another body. And he took the body of queen. Queen of a different king, Malayadvaja, and the name of the queen was Vaidarbhi. You know, the name of the king was Malayadvaja, and then there was Vaidarbhi. So, you know, she was a faithful wife, and eventually her husband died, and then she was very distraught. You know, her husband died, and she's all alone, and she didn't know what to do, and just kind of crying out, what's the meaning of existence? Because eventually the soul comes to this point where you just throw up your hands and say, what is going on in this material world? Why am I here? Why am I suffering like this? And so at that point, this Brahman comes and says, oh, you know, don't you remember me? I'm your unknown friend. In other words, this is like the super soul, the Avijñāta Sakkha saying. And he tells her, well, actually, you know, this is not our real home. And he explains the whole analogy of the city of 9 gates. He said, but this is not our real home. We come from somewhere else. And we're meant to go back there. We're meant to, you know, be in that original position. You've simply come here. You've entered into this material world, and you become entangled in all this, but really, our real home is elsewhere. So this is what the real business of, you know, the super soul is. It's to remind us of our real position. But our real position isn't to be eternally related to, you know, the super soul. The super soul simply accompanies us during our sojourn here in this material world. And the super soul is an expansion, simply a localized, partial expansion of the original personality of Godhead. So, does anybody have any questions about that story before? Because we're going to spend the rest of the time going over the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which has a lot of information about the super soul. Okay, so we go to chapter 13. And this is the name of this chapter is called Nature, the Enjoyer, and Consciousness. And we'll start with text 3. And there Krishna is saying, Chetrajam chapimam vidhi sarva chetreshu bharata chetraja chetra gyor gyanam yach tach gyanam atam mama. So then Krishna is saying, O Sayana Bharata, you should understand that I am also the knower in all bodies, and to understand this body and its knower is called knowledge. That is my opinion. Because there's actually two knowers in the body. There's the soul and then the super soul. And Krishna's already explained that, yes, there's a body and then there's the knower of the body. And then in this verse, Krishna says, you should understand that I am also the knower in all bodies. Not just a single body, but all bodies. And to understand this body and its knower is called knowledge. So then, in his purport, Śrīla Prabhupāda further expands on this. He explains, yes, that in each body, there's the Lord, the living entity, and then the body itself is made of matter. And the super soul, he explains, is an expansion of the personality of Godhead. He's present in all the different bodies, and then Śrīla Prabhupāda gives the example of like a king, he knows everything that's going on in the entire kingdom, whereas the proprietor of just a house or some plot of land in the kingdom only knows what's going on in his own area, but the king knows what's going on everywhere. Srila Prabhupada goes on to explain that the body is called like the chetra, which is a field. And then there's the knower of the field, the chetra gya. There's an interesting section of the purport where Srila Prabhupada says, it's in the middle of the next to the last paragraph. Srila Prabhupada is saying, one who does not understand the field of activity and the knower of activity is not in perfect knowledge. One has to understand the position of Prakriti, nature, Purusha, the enjoyer of nature, and Ishvara, the knower who dominates or controls nature and the individual soul. It says, one should not confuse the three in their different capacities. One should not confuse the painter, the painting, and the easel. The material world, which is the field of activities, is nature, and the enjoyer of nature is the living entity, and above them both is the supreme controller, the personality of Godhead. So, in terms of this discussion, Prakriti is the material body and material nature, then the Purusha would be the soul, and then the Ishvara would be the supreme controller, or Krishna, who is acting in the capacity of the super soul. Then, if we go on to text, there's a section of text from 14 to 18 in the 13th chapter, where there's some description of the super soul. So, in text 14, Krishna says, everywhere are his hands and legs, his eyes, heads, and faces, and he has ears everywhere. In this way, the super soul exists, pervading everything. And in this purport, Srila Prabhupada explains, as the sun exists, diffusing its unlimited rays, so does the super soul, or supreme personality of Godhead. He exists in his all-pervading form, and in him exist all the individual living entities, beginning from the first great teacher, Brahma, down to the small ants. There are unlimited heads, legs, hands, and eyes, and unlimited living entities. All are existing in and on the super soul. Therefore, the super soul is all-pervading. The individual soul, however, cannot say that he has his hands, legs, and eyes everywhere. That is not possible. If he thinks that under ignorance, He is not conscious that his hands and legs are diffused all over, but when he attains to proper knowledge, he will come to that stage. His thinking is contradictory. This means that the individual soul, having become conditioned by material nature, is not supreme. The supreme is different from the individual soul. The Supreme Lord can extend his hand without limit, but the individual soul cannot. In Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says that if anyone offers him a flower or a fruit or a little water, he accepts it. If the Lord is a far distance away, how can he accept things? This is the omnipotence of the Lord. Even though he is situated in his own abode far, far away from earth, he can extend his hand to accept what anyone offers. That is his potency. So this is really kind of interesting verse, you know, to try to contemplate how Krishna has his, a super soul, has his hands and legs and eyes and heads and faces and ears everywhere. Because going through this purport, I guess there are a couple of ways to understand that. In one sense, you could say that Krishna owns all the hands and legs and of every living entity anyways. It's all his property and it's all his creation. So in that sense, you could say his hands and legs and eyes are everywhere. And then the other sense is that even though Krishna is situated in his eternal abode, he is present everywhere. He can expand himself as, you know, the super soul everywhere, and being present everywhere as the super soul, then he's wherever Krishna is, there are his hands, there's his legs, there's his ears, everything is there. All his spiritual senses are there. So this is quite an amazing concept. And then Srila Prabhupada says that if somebody thinks that actually his own hands and legs and like that are spread all over the universe, but he's just in ignorance of that, then that's really a false conception. You know, that's what the impersonalists think. Then, in the next verse, text 15, Krishna says, the super soul is the original source of all senses, yet he is without senses. He is unattached, although he is the maintainer of all living beings. He transcends the modes of nature, and at the same time, he is the master of all the modes of material nature. Then he explains in a purport, the Supreme Lord, although the source of all the senses of the living entities, doesn't have material senses like they have. Actually, the individual souls have spiritual senses, but in conditioned life, they are covered with material elements, and therefore the sense activities are exhibited through matter. The Supreme Lord's senses are not covered by matter. Then we go down a little bit further, and it says, the Supreme Personality of Godhead has no hands which are materially contaminated, but he has hands and accepts whatever sacrifice is offered to him. The distinction between the conditioned soul and the super soul. That is the distinction between the conditioned soul and the super soul. He has no material eyes, but he has eyes. Otherwise, how could he see?